Boker Tov, Erev Tov, everybody, and Bakasha, after that intro, Shuli Bakasha, part four, the modern state of Israel. Okay, let's go. Thank you very much.
Okay, hi, everybody. So today, after we've been through the travails of the British Mandate, early Zionism, the War of Independence, today we're really going to be discussing the challenges of the first decade ish, right, of the state of Israel, and the greatest challenge. There are many, many challenges, right? Issues of building infrastructure and economy and defending ourselves, right, and all the things that come along with creating a state. But perhaps the biggest challenge is what complicates all of this, and that is the incredibly enormous influx of immigrants that happened in the first decade of the state. So just to give you numbers, we'll go into it a little bit more deeply, but between May 15th, 1948 to December 31st, 1951, you have 686,739 immigrants. I will remind you that Israel's population on May 15th, 1948 is 600,000 people. So Israel doubles its population in 3 years, okay? In 12 years, between 48 and 60, the total of immigrants is approximately 1 million people, okay? So huge, huge numbers flowing into the country. And not only that, coming from literally over 70 different countries, different cultures, different languages, right? On the one hand, this beautiful kibbutz galuyot and gathering of the exiles, all of the relatives, the cousins from far away coming back together. On the other hand, obviously, very great complications. We are a very poor country in 1948. We have no infrastructure. We have no places for people to live. We have no food to feed them. How does Israel deal with that? So that's really what we're going to be talking about today, with a few other things thrown in. We're not going to talk so much about divided Jerusalem or the security issues of the country. We're going to save that for next time when we talk about the events leading up to the Six-Day War and the Six-Day War itself. But today is mostly about Aliyah and the Aliyah experience, which still shapes us as a country so much today. And that's partly why I'm also going to put in a couple of songs, because this has made its way very much into popular culture as well. So we'll see as we go along. So let's understand where we are in 1949. Okay, so take a look at this map. You may recall from last time the map we had that the United Nations had proposed of partition, right? Partition map was worse, okay? In the partition map, Israel got only half of the Galilee, okay? Did not get any of Jerusalem. So let's say, this is a terrible drawing, but you get a sort of a sense, right? So Jerusalem was international. We didn't get anything of that, right? And even on the coast, it was a little more complicated. But after the War of Independence, after the dust clears, we end up with the whole Galilee, with the area of the coast up until Gaza, the Negev, obviously. We're missing quite a lot, right? We're missing the Golan, we're missing Yehuda and Shomron, the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, but we have half of Jerusalem, right? And like I said, that's what we're going to talk about next time. And we have much more than we had planned on having before. Okay, so it's a complicated map, but it's a better map than what had existed earlier. Okay, we also have the very complicated transfer of populations. Okay, we're going to see that Arabs who flee from cities and neighborhoods that are conquered by Israel, right? Ramla, Tzfat, Haifa, a lot of other places. Jews that have to flee from place, or sometimes were killed in places that have been Jewish areas conquered by Arabs, Gush Etzion, for example, hey, the old city of Jerusalem. So not such a simple reality, but definitely much better than what we had been made to expect under partition, and much better than what many thought, right? That it would really be just another Holocaust. Thank God that is not what happened. Hey, but we still have this desperate need for manpower, for food sources. Okay, we are, like I said, a very poor country. And in order to kind of contain that poverty, what the government puts into effect is what's called tsena, right? Tsena, austerity, rationing. There's very, very strong limits on imports, on spending dollars, right? Or any foreign currency. Everybody gets, for the first few years at least, ration books. And that's what you could see. I actually found this on eBay. It's amazing, right? This is your, on the right here, your little ration book, Mr. Ariel Kahana, right? You get certain amount that you can buy every week, and that's it, right? Very, very little. Just to give you a little bit of a sense, okay? Every person got a ration of 125 grams of meat per month. Per month, okay? That's not even a hamburger, okay? Per month. On the other hand, you got unlimited bread, and anybody who knows a little bit about Israeli cuisine, not in the last 15, 20 years when we've become this like foodie destination, but earlier, we could hardly call it cuisine, right? But the idea of how to make do with less, and some of us who've been living here for a while have cookbooks that are like a million and one things you can do with eggplant, right? All these, what do we do with the limited resources that we have? We can't import. One great example, we have very limited imports, but the Sephardi Jews see rice as an incredible staple, but rice doesn't grow locally here. So what does Ben-Gurion do? He goes to the food scientists at OSEM and he says, I want you to invent a substitute for rice. And they come up with a flour-based substitute for rice, which is what we call ptitim, or Israeli couscous is what it's called in North America, right? And this is, but what it was called in the 50s was Ben-Gurion rice, because there was no rice, right? You can see these guys in the picture lining up for coffee. And the coffee leads us to the fact that when you have rationing and you have austerity, what naturally happens in humanity is you have a black market, right? And black markets developed for all sorts of things, from dollars. And those of us who remember coming to Israel for the first time 30 years ago, remember the complications of changing your dollars, right? It was all very, very serious, even up till 30 years ago. Today, come with whatever you want, take whatever you want. But black market in currency, but black market in goods as well. And famous joke from those years, right? Somebody came, comes in, everything, of course, in has to go through customs in the airport. It comes in with these huge sacks, right, of coffee. Obviously, he's going to sell coffee on the black market. And the custom inspector says, what's this? And he says, it's bird food. And the custom inspector takes the bag and he lifts it up and he smells it. Clearly doesn't smell like bird food. He says, this is for the birds. The birds are going to eat this. He says, yirtzu yochlu, lo yirtzu lo yochlu. If they want to eat it, they'll eat it. If they don't want to eat it, they won't eat it. All right. But the joking concealed the fact that there really was very little in this country to have. And that's going to be part of our story, because the new Olim, the new immigrants, are going to be sent to places where they can farm, okay? Because we need agriculture. We need to have stuff that is going to sustain us, okay? Very important law, right? One of the major ideas of Zionism, Jews kicked out, exiled from country after country, century after century. Here, this is your home. You can come here and nobody will stop you. So in 1950, and of course, this is also in response to the British restrictions that have been on immigration, the Turkish restrictions, okay? In 1950, the Knesset passes the law of return, which of course is still is still around today, a controversial law, but an important law. Every Jew has the right to come to this country as an olé, right? An olé visa will be granted to every Jew who has expressed his desire to settle in Israel, unless the Minister of Immigration is satisfied the applicant is engaged in an activity directed against the Jewish people, is likely to endanger public health, right? Some people may know the story, you know, that in the 50s, you had various famous Jewish mobsters who wanted to come and seek refuge in the state of Israel, right? Bugsy Siegel and people like that. That's really who we're talking about when we're talking about endangering public health. Right. So basically, anyone who is Jewish wants to come to this country and become a citizen can do that, no problem. What is the problem here? Well, there's a little bit of this definition question of who is a Jew. What does it mean that you're Jewish? Does it mean your father's Jewish? Does it mean your mother's Jewish? Does it mean that you converted? What if you're a Jew who converted to Christianity, right? Famous story that we had of somebody named Father Daniel, who converted during the Holocaust and then wanted to come here as a Jew, right? The halacha says you're a Jew always. What about the law? So all of these questions were kind of floating around. It's only in 1970 that they start to deal with this question, but it's still a question we're dealing with today. But the basic underlying premise of this idea is all Jews are welcome. All Jews should come. And once the gates are opened, oh boy, everybody's coming. Okay, so we're going to look at the numbers. People, by the way, I sent this out in source sheets. So if you want to see the numbers, not in the map, which I apologize, is a little bit hard to see, but you actually have numbers of who comes where. Okay, but we're going to be talking basically about two major groups who are coming to Israel in that first decade. Okay, we have Jews who are coming from Europe, and most of those are survivors, all of them really survivors, coming from DP camps, coming post-Holocaust refugees, okay? And these are our refugees coming from Europe, and you can see the incredible, incredible numbers, right? And in some cases, the numbers are large, even if the Jewish community was larger in other places. So for example, trying to find it here on the map, right? From Poland, we have 156,000 Jews, which is a nice number, but it's not anything compared to the number of Jews that were in Poland pre-Holocaust, but unfortunately, Poland was one of the places that was most decimated by the Holocaust, right? As opposed to Romania, which was more spared. And here you have over 200,000 Jews coming from Romania. Soviet Union, massive, massive Jewish population, but the Iron Curtain has shut, has clamped down, and those Soviet Jews are not getting here until decades later. So very interesting, very complicated numbers that are coming here. Okay, the early years are really the European survivors. But we also have the huge numbers that are coming. This is the second group coming from the Arab countries. And we're going to talk about the differences between each one's desire to come here. Okay. Some different countries in different ways, by the way, right? Huge aliyah from Morocco, 260,000 people, but they don't come all at once. They come gradually over the course of about 15 years. We'll discuss a little bit the reasons. Huge aliyah from Iraq, but they come literally all at once, right? They're coming, they're being just taken out one after the other. Same thing with the Yemenite Jews. So it's different aspects of how they're coming, different time periods that they're coming, right? Egypt, they're coming after Nasser comes to power in 1954. Jews had a very comfortable life in Egypt, and then suddenly they're expelled, they lose all their property. There's the Suez Crisis in 1956, and suddenly Egyptian Jews are persona non grata, and they have to leave. So various socio-political reasons and economic reasons in different places. Just to take a quick look at numbers and at the majority in the various years. Okay, so 48, 49, 50. Okay, huge numbers coming in. This is what I said. This is this more than 600,000 coming in those first 3 years. Many, many, many of them are survivors, are Holocaust survivors. Plus you have this mass aliyah from Yemen, which is 4950, and then from Iraq, 5051. Okay, so look at those incredible numbers over those years. Then starts to taper off a little bit, right? And you get it coming in more in dribs and drabs, right? So Morocco, you have 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, but they're not coming in all at once, okay? 57, you have this boom of many more Jews coming from Egypt because of what's happening in Egypt, right? Also from Europe because of the situation in Czechoslovakia and various other places, right? So complicated and different reasons, but they're all coming in over this very short period of time. This, of course, is not dealing at all with the aliyah of Soviet Jews, with the aliyah of Ethiopian Jews. We're really only going to be talking about those, that first decade. Okay? The later aliyah is also important, but not something that we're going to talk about today. Okay, so let's try to take apart a little bit why they're coming. Now, European Jews who come after the Holocaust, as opposed to the many, many European Jews who come before, right? So much of the first, second, third, fourth, fifth Aliyah are European Jews. This is the large majority of Jews who are coming and building up the state. You do have Yemenite Jews, you do have other Jews, but so many Europeans. Most of those are coming for ideological reasons, not as much the German Jews in the 1930s. They're coming because they're kicked out of Germany, but a large number of those are coming for ideological reasons. The Jews who are coming after the Holocaust are Zionists because of what happened to them, right? They're Zionists in spite of themselves in certain cases. We're going to see the complicated relationship that happens between the European Jews who come after the Holocaust and the European Jews who had been here during the War of Independence. In many cases, by the way, same family, right? Same family. One brother immigrated before, one brother didn't want to leave, had a business, had a family, had whatever responsibilities and stayed. How do they relate to each other? But when they come already at this point, maybe they might not have been Zionists before, but now they are Zionists in spite of themselves. And we have all kinds of fascinating testimony, right? I'll just read you something from a survivor. His name is Benny Wurzburg, a young guy. He comes here. A lot of these guys, by the way, immediately go into the army, certainly if they came before 48. And he's writing about how what he felt when he swears allegiance to the Haganah. Okay, he remembers standing in front of a Nazi officer and being powerless. And he says, I'll read it to you in Hebrew and I'll translate. Lefichach hirgashti ki ein ani nishba imunim rak lahagana. I felt that I was not swearing allegiance only to the Haganah, ela nishba kama shavuot acherot. I am swearing a few other oaths. Shvuat nikama lidam horai hanirtzachim ukrovai hamuralim. Right, an oath of vengeance for my murdered parents and relatives. Shvuat linkom kvod ami hanidkeva hamushpal, an oath to avenge the honor of my depressed and humiliated people. Shvu'al inkom damam shel Yehudim, an oath to avenge the blood of the Jews. Va'az zoha pam harishona, and then for the very first time, hirgashti ki lo shagiti bezeh shene'evakti v'nish'arti b'chayim, and then for the very first time, I felt that I hadn't made a mistake in fighting to stay alive, right? So we have these very complex feelings that are going on with the European Jews. Meanwhile, we have the Jews who are coming from the Arab countries. Hey, this iconic picture of Yemenite Jews who are coming. By the way, if you look it up, if you look up like Yemenite Aliyah, you can see this picture, which A, has been colorized, and B, they actually know who all these people are, and they've given them names, which is great. But the Arab countries is a little bit more complicated, right? Obviously, when they come after 48, they're coming because they are in deep trouble in the Arab countries. Arab countries where Jews and Arabs had lived side by side for centuries, more or less in peace, with some very notable exceptions. With the founding of the State of Israel, the Arab countries turn against their Jews to a large extent. So there is definitely persecution, there are economic reasons, but there is a deep current in the Arab countries, in the Jews of the Arab countries, particularly in Yemen, in Libya, in Morocco, of Zionism, right? And a feeling that not Zionism in the secular sense of the first Aliyah, the second Aliyah of the European Jews, but a very deep sense that the redemption has come, right? God is calling us to come back, and now is the time, and we have to go, right? We have this great testimony from a Moroccan rabbi named Rabbi Shlomo Ben Harush, right? Where he comes home, we're going to read at the very end about the Israeli shlichim, the emissaries who come to the various countries and prepare people for Aliyah. And they come to Morocco and they come to this Rabbi Shlomo Ben Harush, and he decides it's time to go. And he comes home, he tells his wife it's time to go. And she says, but I'm 9 months pregnant. And he says, it doesn't matter. We shouldn't wait, right? We have the opportunity now to go. Now is the time. And his friends say, but you have a good job. And he says, limkor garinim baruchov hineni muchan haikar liyot be'eretz ha'avot chemdat levavot. I am willing to sell seeds in the street. The main thing is to be in the land that has been promised to our fathers. So you have this powerful moment of feelings of redemption. I won't say everybody feels like this, but it definitely is an undercurrent, different than that feeling of desire for vengeance, desire for self-worth of the Holocaust survivors. So a few very big operations, okay? The Yemenite Jews, one of the most famous ones, right? In English, it's often called the magic carpet, but in Hebrew, it's called Al Kanfei Nisharim, on eagle's wings, really on vulture's wings, because that's what an Esher is, but on Engel's wings, sounds better in English. And just the picture is a great picture. There's a guy who is a graffiti artist, and over the past few years, he's been going to the stall owners in the Shuk in Machane Yehuda, you know, and they close their metal shutters at night, and he's asked permission to decorate the shutters, and he's created amazing artworks all over the Shuk, which you can really only see at night or very, very early in the morning. And this is one of them in honor of this operation, right? Here's our Nesher and the planes that are flying, right? And the Yemenite Jews, who already, there was a Yemenite Aliyah. This is not the first Yemenite Aliyah. This is the Yemenite Aliyah already in the 1880s, Aleb Tamar. And there are Yemenite Jews who continue to come throughout the early 20th century. But here already there is this desire to get everybody out. The Zionist shlichim, the Zionist emissaries come to Yemen. They cannot go to the major Yemen cities because the Yemenite government won't allow them. So they have to go to the port of Aden, right, on the Red Sea, because that's controlled by the British. And meanwhile, Jews start streaming there from all over the countries, just coming in huge numbers, right, so that they can be processed there. And they're put onto cargo planes, right? They're put onto these huge cargo planes, 500, 600 people on each plane. And they're just ready, right? They're ready. They're going to go. And we have this great story of Golda Meir, right, who comes to, well, I'll tell you two stories. First of all, Yitzhak Ben Zvi. Yitzhak Ben Zvi is the second president of Israel. He's the president from 1952, but he's very involved in all the Zionist things even before that. When he becomes president, he is fascinated by Jews from all over the world. And in the president's house, he hosts receptions every month, Rosh Chodesh, for a different community, right? A different Jews from Afghanistan, Jews from Iraq, Jews from Russia, right? From everywhere. But he writes that he actually went to Aden with the Jewish agency to accompany one of these flights. And he's on the plane. They're flying back and somebody looks out the window and they see the Red Sea below them and somebody starts singing and everyone on the plane joins in. What are they singing? Az Yashir, Shirat Hayam, right? They're singing the song that the Jews sing as they cross the Red Sea with Moses. So that's Yitzhak Ben Zvi's story. But the other great story is Golda Meir, right? Golda Meir would come to the airport sometimes to greet the plane loads of immigrants. And when she got there once, she sees an old man, right? And she says to him, what did you think? You know, when they were, you've never seen a plane before. Were you frightened to get on the plane? And he says, what are you talking about? This is exactly what God told Isaiah. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up like with wings as eagles. Kovei Adonai yachlifu koach, ya'alu ever kanisharim, yarutsu velo yigau. He says, what do you think the eagles? Do you think they're really eagles? These are the eagles, right? This is how we're going to come to the land of Israel. So this definite feeling of redemption, of this very important moment, right? And that's what's going on with the Jews of Iran, the Jews of Yemen, excuse me. The Jews of Iraq, different story. Very difficult story. Jews of Iraq, unlike the Jews of Yemen, which in many cases they were really desperately poor, and there was a lot of anti-Semitism in Yemen. Not everybody was poor, but it was a difficult life for Jews in Yemen. Jews in Iraq, which of course is the oldest continuous diaspora, because Iraq is Babylonia. And they had really built up a very good life for themselves. Businessmen, educators, involved in the administration, right? Very middle class, middle to upper class. And they felt very at home. And that's kind of extremely shaken in 1941 when there's this terrible pogrom called the Farhud. Now, in terms of numbers, if you want to compare it to pogroms in Europe or the Holocaust, it's nothing to compare. But it was terrifying for these Jews who had never seen such a thing before and their Arab neighbors turning against them. And they realize that it's time to leave. But the Iraqis don't want them to leave. And there have to be all of these secret negotiations, many of them done by these two men, Shlomo Hillel here on the left, and Mordechai ben Porat, both of them become very important in Israeli government later. Basically, they work out a deal with the Iraqi government where Israel pays cash, right? They pay cash for each citizen, each Jew to leave, and cash that Israel did not have, but there was this feeling that they had to get them out. Of course, when you leave, you can't take anything with you. So all of these middle to upper class bankers, businessmen, civil servants, they're coming here with nothing, right? Completely penniless. And they have to start from the very beginning. And the state doesn't have all that much to give them when they come here with nothing, right? But this is the Aliyah of Iraqi Jews, 123,000 in 2 years, okay? Coming back to our European Jews for a moment, okay, we have the story of what's called Youth Aliyah. Okay? Youth Aliyah was founded in the 1930s by this woman here on the left, Recha Freier. Youth Aliyah is usually associated with the woman on the right, Henrietta Zold, who was an amazing woman in every way, but she was not the founder of Youth Aliyah. Recha Freier was the founder of Youth Aliyah. She worked and saved literally thousands of Jewish children, getting them out of Europe before the war and then after the war. She wasn't treated very well. She was kind of unceremoniously kicked out of her position, and Henrietta Zold took over. But essentially, between the two of them, they brought so many Jewish youth here. And again, complicated story, right? You have to rebuild your lives. In most cases, these are youth and teenagers who are coming with nobody, right? Their parents have been killed, or they leave their parents and then their parents don't get out, and they have to rebuild their lives and start from the beginning. Now, the largest question for Israel, one of the many questions, is where are you going to put all these people? Where are they going to go? You could say, okay, there's a lot of unsettled areas, but there's nothing to put them in. Okay, so at first, what they do is they move them into abandoned Arab neighborhoods and Arab towns, right? So you have a couple pictures here. The picture on the left here is from Ramleh. Okay, Ramla and Lud, important and hostile Arab towns near the center. When Israel conquers them, and this is a controversial story, were they kicked out? Were they allowed to leave? Were they expelled, right? That's a story in and of itself. But basically, these places are now standing empty, and Jews are moved into them, right? Moved into those places. You also had neighborhoods in cities, right? The picture on the right is of a beautiful Arab house in Katamon in Jerusalem. Arabs, usually Christian Arabs, lived in a lot of neighborhoods in West Jerusalem, Katamon, Baca, San Simon, often with very beautiful houses. You had similar situations, Arabs living in neighborhoods in Haifa, Jaffa, Tzfat, right? And they flee when these places are conquered by the Jews. And so the first wave, and often that first wave are the Europeans, by the way, they're put into these places. They're put into Ashkelon, into Akko, into Ramla, into Lod, right? Tzfat, Tveria, Haifa, neighborhoods in all sorts of other cities. And that's kind of, they get the better deal, right? They get the better deal. I was just tour guiding today in Ein Karim in Jerusalem. New immigrants didn't want to be in Ein Karim, but at least they were very close to Jerusalem. They're in a place that has some potential for settlement. But this is the first round. The next round, we'll come back to this in a second, okay? The next round are housed in British Army camps. There's no place to put them. There's no work, there's no food, there's nothing. And this is an untenable situation. So they come up with what are called ma'abarot, transit camps. Okay, we'll come back to that. But let's just talk about this for a second because this is connected to what we were saying. All right, Arab refugees, Arabs from where they fled and where they went, right? So this just gives you a little bit of a taste, right? Towns that Arabs fled from, Jaffa, Ramla, Beersheba, Haifa, Akko, Tveria, Sfat. Where are they going? They're going to all sorts of places. A lot of them going to the West Bank, going to Gaza, okay? Some of them going to Jordan and Syria, okay? But many of them staying really within the country, the flip side, the mirror image of the story of Israel and its immigrants is the story of what does the Arab world do with its refugees. And Israel, for all the troubles and the difficulties that we had in building neighborhoods and homes and economic depression, and it wasn't easy, but we managed to house these million people in 12 years. Whereas the Arabs, despite the wealth of the Arab world and the enormity of the Arab world, the refugees are kept in refugee camps, and we still have refugee camps four generations later, which is a terrible thing, created a terrible situation. But like I said, that's the mirror image of this story. But let's go back to our Jewish story. Okay. First, they're put in abandoned British Army camps. And this is just a breeding ground for everything bad, right? They have nothing to do. They have nowhere to go. It's just a place of despair. So along comes the head of the settlement division of the Jewish Agency, and that's Levi Eshkol, who's going to be the prime minister during the Six-Day War. And he says, okay, we're going to build temporary settlements. Meanwhile, we're going to send them to go to work, and the government will at the same time build them permanent housing. What are these temporary settlements called? Ma'abarot. Now, some of these ma'abarot, right, eventually are planned to become cities. Kiryat Shmona starts as a ma'abara. Hey, Kiryat Malachi starts as a ma'abara. Rosh Ha'ayin, right? They become big cities. It takes a while. It's not so simple. Meanwhile, the conditions in the ma'abarot are terrible. Right, they're living in tents, they're living in tin huts, the sanitation is awful, right? Some are there for 10 years or more. If anybody knows the very, very famous and very well done Israeli classic movie, Salach Shabbati, right? Salach Shabbati is about an immigrant, a Yemenite immigrant played by Chaim Topol, who comes and who's dumped in one of these ma'abarot, and it's a satire and it's a parody, but you can see a lot of the truth that is coming through and how long it takes to build anything and how complicated it is. Okay. Now, who's in charge of these ma'abarot? Who's dealing with the day-to-day lots and lots and lots of issues, health issues, economic issues, sending people to work issues, right? Who's dealing with it? Well, what does Israel have as manpower? The army. So who gets sent to all these places? Soldiers who are 18, 19, maybe 20 years old, right? And they are the ones who are in charge because there's really nobody else to be in charge, right? Israel has a concept called Rosh Gadol, right? Big head. You're supposed to think big. You're supposed to solve problems on your own. And here are these, you know, 19-year-old soldiers who are meant to solve all these problems. Meanwhile, there's no infrastructure. There's no drainage, okay? You have ma'abarot where in the winter it floods and things are swept away, okay? They have to evacuate people. They have to deal with all kinds of health issues. They have to get in supplies, and they're very, very young, right? Besides the fact that they're very, very young, there's a lot of cultural bias, right? Think about it, right? You're a young 19-year-old girl who's sent to be the nurse, right? Take a look over here in the Kupat Cholim, and in are coming these, you know, country women from Yemen, right? And we have stories about how they would come in with their children, and the young Israeli Sabra nurses would say to them, you know, let us talk to you a little bit about birth control. And they would freak out completely. What are you talking about, right? Cultural bias, larger problems than that, the whole story of the Yemenite children and what happened to them. We're not going to go into that story, but it's a very deep wound in the Yemenite community. And it's a difficult thing. On the other hand, there's this feeling of being pioneers, of brotherhood, of coming together, and of also seeing our relatives and the cultures that they came from. And there was a lot of good that was done as well. I just met somebody the other day. I was at a wedding, and she told me that this was her career. She was a nurse in the government health services, and she was sent out to these places to teach people about vaccines and public health and how do you take care of your children. You know, some of them coming from very sophisticated places, but some of them coming from very primitive places and how to deal with that. So the army, right, we have a phrase in Hebrew, Am bonet tzava bonet am, right? A people builds an army that builds a people, right? And the army in Israel has never been only about defense. It's always been about being involved in social situations, economic situations, cultural situations, and that's what's going on here. Now, one of the places that needs people, right? We have a place that a people that needs a place and a place that needs people. And that's the Negev, okay? Ultimately, these ma'abarot cannot continue and you need to build new towns. And we're going to see what those towns are in a minute. But where are you going to put a lot of them? You're going to put a lot of them in the south. And this is the vision of David Ben-Gurion. David Ben-Gurion's vision already from the beginning, long before the state is created, is what you see in the statement here below. The state of Israel to exist must go south. The Negev has enormous difficulties for settlement, but enormous potential, right? Lots and lots of empty space. Ben-Gurion really believed that this is where the pioneers have to go. And this is the future of the state of Israel. He doesn't just talk about this. He actually does it, right? At a certain point, he quits being prime minister and he goes down and he joins Kibbutz Sde Boker and he works as a laborer, right? They're not so thrilled to have this old man as a laborer, but that's what he does. And that's really his vision. So Israel starts to build all of what we'll call development towns, what we're called development towns, which are a little bit, unfortunately, of an oxymoron. And you can see in the map, right? Even if you can't read the Hebrew, but you can clearly see that many of them are clustered here in the Negev, right? Mitzpe Ramon, Yerucham, Dimona, Ofakim, Netivot, Sderot, right? These are all development towns. The idea being that we will send the immigrants here, as well as to other ones, right? Netzrat Elit, Migdal HaEmek, Yokneam, right? Other places, but usually it's on the periphery. What's the concept? The concept is we're going to send you here and you'll have a home. Meanwhile, you will defend the borders of the country and you're going to raise, you know, you're going to be farmers and you're going to raise the food that we need. Now, remember that this is the 1950s. Israel is a very paternalistic place, right? And we don't really care if you were a banker in Baghdad, or you were, you know, you had a hardware store in Libya, or in Tunisia. You're going to be a farmer and you're going to raise chickens and you're going to guard the border because that is what the state needs. Now, we're going to see the backlash to that at the end of this class, but that's really what they did. And on the plus side of the equation, right, we could definitely talk about the negative side of the equation, which is that people's personal feelings were not considered in the least, okay? As well as the fact that a lot of these towns really suffered from economic depression, stagnation. It took them a long time. And even today, not all of them have come out of it, right? On the plus side of the equation, everybody got a home. Nobody was left in the ma'abarot, right? A home, a garden, a place to grow and to become something more, right? So complicated story, interesting story. Let's flip back for a minute to the story of the European Jews who are coming here. And I mentioned this in the beginning. Many of the European Jews who are coming here, right, on the one hand, they are coming from the same background as so many of the Jews who are living here already. So you would think that would make it easier for them, right? Culturally, linguistically, that they have a little bit of a footing here. Some of them have relatives here, right? On the other hand, it sort of makes it harder for them because there is very much this feeling in 1950s Israel of, well, you were in trouble, but we were in trouble too. We had a war, we had enemies. What did we do? We took up arms and we fought. What did you do? You went, in the very famous and very infamous and very terrible phrase, you went like lambs to the slaughter. And there was really no understanding of the enormity of the Nazi war machine, of the Holocaust, of how Jews were trapped and they had no way out. And there was very much the sense of the European Jews as very passive, right? A terrible, terrible name that was given to European Jews, Holocaust survivors, was sabonim, soap. Right? You're passive like soap. You're even made into soap by the Nazis. And the Jews themselves, the survivors themselves who come, they want to move on. They don't want to dwell on this. They want to start again, right? It's a very complicated baggage that they're bringing with them. Now, Israel takes a step towards recognizing all of this. And next time when we talk about Jerusalem, I'm going to talk a little about the very first Holocaust museum, which is the Chamber of the Holocaust. But this is not the first Holocaust museum, but it's a very important one, of course, and that's Yad Vashem. Okay? In 1953, Israel takes the step of passing the Yad Vashem law, which says we have to have a Holocaust Memorial Day and we have to have a Holocaust Museum, which is already a huge step towards recognition. But, right? What's the focus? The focus is on heroism. The focus is on military resistance. And extremely famous sculptures in the original Yad Vashem, they're still there, but people don't see them as much because of the new museum. These two sculptures, one is a sculpture, one is a relief by Nathan Rappaport. Okay. One of them is on the right here is those Jews, those traditional Jews carrying their Torah downtrodden like Jews throughout history, going like lambs to the slaughter. Contrast that to the Greek gods, right? On the left, these are the fighters of the Warsaw Ghetto. And these are the people that we can admire and we can look up to. And that's why, by the way, Holocaust Remembrance Day is very close to the date of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. That's what we can cope with, okay? It takes a long, long time till Israel matures enough to understand the story of the Holocaust. We're going to see what happens and how that happens in a minute. But before that, we have other Holocaust-related controversies, right? Two stories that really rocked the very young state in the 1950s. One, of course, is the story of the reparation money. Okay. Germany, Western Germany, right, after the war, is willing to give money that the state desperately, desperately needs. We're talking about millions and millions of dollars, and we have nothing. Okay. And on the one hand, you have David Ben-Gurion, who says, first of all, we need this money. It's a very practical thing. We have nothing. We need this money. And second, he says, quoting, you know, the Book of Kings, Haratzachta v'gam yarashta. Did you murder and now you're also going to inherit? You took everything from the Jews of your country and now you're going to keep their assets? No, you're going to give them to us. On the other side of the equation is the gentleman standing here on the balcony, right? Menachem Begin, of course, who in extremely fiery language talks about, what are you going to, how much is grandpa worth? How much is grandma worth? You are kvodenu lo yimacher bekesef, damenu lo yichupar bischorot. Our honor will not be sold with money. Our blood will not be atoned by business. Nimche et hacherpa. We will erase the humiliation and the embarrassment. And this is insanely passionate debate. They march on the Knesset. There's violence, right? And Begin in his best speech-making demagoguery, right? Talking about how we are allowing the Germans to gain atonement by just paying us this blood money. Ultimately, even though Begin definitely has a point, Ben-Gurion's practical approach wins out and we accept the reparations money, but it's a very deep controversy in the early state. Another story, which goes back to the same question of how did the Jews of Israel react to the Jews of Europe of the Holocaust, but during the Holocaust, is the story of the gentleman over here on the right. And this is someone named Rudolf Kastner, a Hungarian Jew who comes to Israel, who brokers a deal during the war, right? The Kastner train brokers a deal between the Nazis and Israel, giving money, paying money in order to get some Jews out. And after the war in the 50s is a journalist who talks about how Kastner basically gave up so many other Jews to get out Jews that he was close with. And what is the relation of the state of Israel to the Nazis? Was it cooperation? Was it collaboration? A very, very controversial trial that everybody listened to. Ultimately, he's exonerated Kastner, but he's then assassinated a few years later. So something that is really burning at the heart of this story. One of the most cathartic moments in this whole story is when Adolf Eichmann is captured by the Mossad in South America. In 1961, he's brought back to trial in Israel. Now, far less important than the fact that he's put on trial and he's eventually executed, right? We want justice to be done, but how much do we care about Eichmann? We just, we don't want to listen to him. But what happens is in the trial becomes the first opportunity for survivors to really come forward and tell their story, right? And the fellow here on the left is Abba Kovner, who was a partisan in the Vilna Ghetto. And survivors come forward. Actually, this was a news item just today. The youngest survivor who testified, he was in his 30s when he testified, meaning he was a teenager during the war. He just died today, yesterday. But they come forward and they testify about what happened. And the importance of the trial is that the people of Israel heard the testimony and for the first time started to really understand what the Jews of Europe had gone through. And it's an extremely cathartic moment. The prosecutor for Israel against Adolf Eichmann is Gideon Hausner. And this is part of his very famous speech. "When I stand before you here, judges of Israel, to lead the prosecution of Adolf Eichmann, I am not standing alone. With me are 6 million accusers, but they cannot rise to their feet and point an accusing finger towards him who sits in the dock and cries, 'I accused,' for their ashes are piled on the hills of Auschwitz and the fields of Treblinka and are strewn in the forests of Poland. Their graves are scattered throughout the length and breadth of Europe. Their blood cries out, but their voice is not heard. Therefore, I will be their spokesman, and in their name, I will unfold the awesome indictment." So very powerful moment in Israel's complex, and still complex, by the way, relationship to the Holocaust. I'll just read you one more quote, and we'll do a little bit of a song. Aaron Appelfeld, right? Famous prize-winning author, child survivor, and he writes about how he had a double identity. He says, "I want to be a real Israeli, but I also have deep longings for my original home," which are sublimated, right? He doesn't want anyone to know that he has longings for his home because, you know, it's that terrible place. But he doesn't think of it as that terrible place. It's his home. It's where he grew up. And he says, "I had a different world, a secret world that nobody knew about." And a lot of survivors and second generation had that secret world. So we're going to do a minute or two of this powerful song. And this is a song that was written by two people whose parents were survivors, Yehuda Palliker, an unusual Greek Jew, but the Greek Jews also had their own Holocaust. He did the music and Yaakov Gilad did the words. His mother was a survivor. It's called A Window to the Mediterranean. And it's a beautiful song because the idea is of the survivors who are always hoping that things will get better. Ryan, I'll just read you a little bit and then I'll play you a little of the song. "I promised to write when I left you. Now I miss you so much. It's a pity you're not here with me. After I arrived in Jaffa, hopes were born out of despair. I found myself a room and a half on the roof of a deserted house. I have a folding bed if the three of us want to sleep. You, the kid, and I against a window looking out to the Mediterranean. And maybe from so far away, there's a one in a million chance. And maybe from so far away, happiness is sneaking through the window." And I'll put on the song, and I'll just tell you while I'm putting on the song that one of the, you know, there was an interview about this song with Yaakov Gilad and, you know, about him writing it. And he says that for him, he asked his mother, you know, how did she ever have the will to go on? And he said she always had hope for a new day, that something would be different.
Want to make it a bit louder, you know, Shuli? I don't know if it's only me, but it's hard to hear the song.
Can't hear it.
Right, that's okay.
Yeah, can't hear.
Shuli, I don't know, like they're pointing out you have to, I don't know, to hit sound share. I'm not exactly sure how that works, but I'm assuming Shuli can't hear us somehow with the transfer of the sound, but
okay. Go back to our pictures here, but I love that song. I just think it's an amazing song.
We can't hear anything.
Okay.
We couldn't hear It's fine. Okay.
You couldn't hear the song at all?
Correct. Yeah, we couldn't hear
it.
We couldn't hear
it. Not at all.
Everybody mute all
not at all. That's
correct. Yeah, you have to share the sound somehow.
Okay, can you hear me now?
We can hear you, but somehow when you put on the song, it didn't come through. Apparently there's a way to share your sound, but we couldn't hear you. It's okay. Maybe at the end of class, we can try it again. Why don't you finish?
All right. So I had a sec.
After the questions, after going through the questions, we'll try those who want
to. Okay. Sorry about that.
Okay. It's okay. Thank you.
Okay. I'll also send you the link to the song for anybody who wants to see. I'll put it in the chat and anyone can put it on later, but you saw the words also. Okay. One more issue we're going to talk about is this story of what today is called Second Israel, Yisrael HaShnia. Okay. As we saw, so many immigrants are coming from Arab countries. There's a lot of cultural bias. Right? There's a belief that who are the people who are here before? They're the Europeans, right? And a lot of them believe that the Jews coming from the Arab countries are primitive. They're not quality material. Certain countries are more desirable than others. Ben-Gurion felt that the Yemenites are very desirable. If you ever think about it, right, what's the big Yemenite city that they're given? They're given Rosh Ha'ayin, which is in the center of the country. It's a very desirable place. Whereas the Moroccans, the North Africans, they're not so desirable. And they get sent off to Ofakim and Sderot, right? There's a thought that these guys are primitive, that they're criminal. Hey, and there's a lot of cultural bias, a lot of contradictory feelings and contradictory ideas that are going on, right? On the one hand, we're sort of a colony, right? Like the British Empire, we're bringing in people from other places and there's conflicts between modern and traditional and European and non-European. On the other hand, we're Zionists, which tells us we're all brothers. We're all brothers. We have to be together. We have to love each other. It's so beautiful. How do you reconcile those different ideas? And a lot of this feeling, by the way, is only emerging now, because now the Mizrachim, the Jews from Arab countries, are firmly entrenched in the establishment, in the culture, in politics, in the army. It took a long time for them to fight their way up. And today, a lot of this feeling is coming out. There was a series in Israel a few years ago called Salach Poza Eretz Yisrael. Salach, here is the land of Israel, right? Playing on this Salach Shabbati that we mentioned. Talking about how they were shunted off to these development towns and stuck in these places that had no future. And we're dealing with this now to a certain extent. And there's also an element of backlash. Okay, in the 1950s, there are riots that begin in 1959 that begin in Haifa in a place called Wadi Salib. There are police officers who come into a very depressed, very Mizrahi neighborhood. There's a brawl going on. Someone attacks them. They shoot back. Somebody's killed, right? A Mizrahi Jew, and riots break out all over the place. And it spreads, right? Now, ultimately, there is a commission of inquiry. And even though they find the policeman was, not guilty, but it was a push to start changing things. Now, some of those things don't really change until Menachem Begin emerges from the opposition in 1977, and he comes to power. Menachem Begin, the whitest of the white Jews, right? Very, very Polish, but with a deep, deep sympathy for Jews from Arab countries and a deep connection, and they love him as well. And he does a lot for them. But even after these Wadi Salib riots, even during the reign of the Labor Party, there's some attempt to improve conditions, but there's a lot of patronizing, right? There's a lot of feeling of that we are better than you and we will tell you what to do because we know best, right? And that backlash is being felt. Now, the other song I wanted to play, and I'm going to try one thing and we'll try it for a minute. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You'll tell me right away. But this is a much newer song, right? This the song I played you from before was written quite a few decades ago. This is a song written by granddaughters of Yemenite immigrants. Okay, these are the, this is a group called Awa, and they are the granddaughters, and they wrote this song. They said this is what they believe would be their grandmother's protest song, and they wrote it in Yemenite Arabic. It's not in Hebrew, and it's a song about, well, let's read it, right? It's about how the expectations as opposed to the reality, right? This is not Yemen. Land of wheat and barley, grape and olive, fig and pomegranate, date and home, right? Shivat Haminim, this is what we're dreaming about. This is where we're going to come to. It's going to be so beautiful. And then you have this kind of back and forth. Where will I make a home? You have a tent, right? Or at least a small shack with four other families. I'll raise a family. Don't let them take your daughter. I'll find myself a job. Cleaning or working the earth, I'll learn the language, lose the accent. With time, I'll feel like I belong. Here isn't Yemen, right? And it goes back, and finally, the end, I came to you as a stranger. You saw me as primitive. I came to you fleeing. I saw you as a last resort. And it's this very strong song. Let's try it. If it doesn't work, you will tell me right away. But it really is a great song. Yeah.
Before you start to make it work, like Steve... Okay, Steve is pointing out that on the bottom, I guess you have to share the computer sound. There's something to hit on your computer to share computer sound.
Share screen.
Go to the bottom of your screen, Shuli.
Uh-huh.
And where it says share your screen, bring up that dialogue box.
Yeah, I did.
And on the bottom, it should say share computer sound.
Oh, you are so right. You are so brilliant. Thank you. Okay.
That was a Google search.
That was beautiful. So let's see if it works. Okay. No, I don't want that one. All right. Hold on. We want this one. Okay. And let's try it. Yeah?
Yes. Yeah, it works. Thank you.
It's a great song. You can play the whole thing to yourselves, but we still have a few things. Thank you for that help. That was amazing. And I think I want to get rid of share sound, right? Because now I'm coming back. Okay. So we're good. We're hearing.
Yes. Yes. We're fine.
Do me a thumbs up or something.
We're fine. Okay. Yeah. We hear. We're
Thank
fine.
You. Okay. So let's summarize for a minute. Okay, so we have one last thing that I want to do. These guys are not part of our old pictures, but they're very powerful. Okay, so let's summarize for a minute. The numbers are unbelievable, right? We have these incredible numbers of immigrants, and they include, you know, the numbers of building homes and cities and roads and economics and infrastructure. And basically, mistakes were made, right? Clearly, mistakes were made. On the other hand, did we provide a safe home for pretty much everyone? Yes, we did. Okay. So was there paternalism? Was there cultural bias? Yes, Did we bring a dream to a million people in 12 years? Yes. Right? And those two pieces have to be weighed against each other. And one of the most beautiful assessments of that is a speech that was given by the woman here on the left. Her name is Miriam Peretz. And she won the Israel Prize 2 years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And she gave an amazing, amazing speech about her immigration. I'm going to read you a piece of it, but we'll come back to the other one in a minute. But this is Miriam Peretz, and I apologize, I don't have a translation of it, but I'll translate it as I go along. Right, and she gives a whole long speech, but this is the introduction. Ubachat ha'leilot shel kaitz 1963, one of the nights of the summer 1963, hodia avi ki ha'leila yavo ha'mashiach. My father told us that tonight the Messiah was going to come. L'sheilati kitzad azaheoto, I asked him, how are we going to know who he is? Ana hu yobash chulta p'tucha mechnasayim k'tzarim v'yin al sandalim. He's going to wear an open shirt, he's going to wear shorts, and he's going to wear sandals. Pagashti et ha-mashiach, I met the Messiah. Shliach ha-sochnut ha-yehudi shehotzi otanu me'amalach b'Casablanca, the emissary from the Jewish agency who got us out of the ghetto of the Melech in Casablanca. Sham garti ad ayot bat eser, right? I lived there till I was 10. And then he brought us to Jerusalem. To Jerusalem, lema'abarat chatzerim be'Be'er Sheva, right? To one of these ma'abarot on the outskirts of Be'er Sheva, chatzerim, sheba chayiti ad shnat 1969. And I lived there. She lived there for 6 years till 1969. Chayinu lelo gaz, lelo mekarer. We live without gas. We live without a refrigerator. Hayu mitot asuyot mi barzel, right? We had these terrible brass, iron bedsteads. Ukshaye klita and difficulties of absorption, the safa chadasha, in a new language, aval hayta gam simcha gdola al shezachinu lahagia le'eretz Yisrael. And there was also this great joy that we had made it to the land of Israel. Lamadati la'ahov et ha'aretz derech shireha. I learned to love the land through its songs. Bizchut radio shekibel abiva bodato kimatatek mitatek fishim. Because my father got a radio in his work as a street cleaner. I guess they had like some gift at some point. B'chol yom revi'i, every Wednesday, chikiti b'cherkat cherdat kodesh b'petach ha'tshrif shelanu. I waited with like holy anticipation in the doorway of our hut. B'yadai machberet b'it haron, in my hand a notebook and a pencil. Nechona lichtov et milot hashirim sheli made Effie Netzer b'tochnito, right? She's listening to this radio show, ready to write down all the words of the song that this Effie Netzer is teaching on his show. Kachi karti et ha-chermon, derech malchut ha-chermon. I learned about the chermon through the song, The Kingdom of the Chermon. Et be'lechem, derech re'i, rachel re'i, right? In the different places, Emek Yisrael, derech shir ha-emek. And she goes on and she talks about how she has so much gratitude and so much love for this country. And yes, it wasn't what she expected, and it didn't always live up to her expectations, but our job is now to come and to give back. And I'll just go back to the other person here, a much newer immigrant. And this is someone named Sharon Shalom, Ethiopian Jew, who comes here with the whole large Ethiopian Aliyah, right? He's much younger. He's born in 1973, right? He says, as a child in Ethiopia, I thought that Jerusalem was made of gold, right? And he comes here and he's disappointed because along with Jerusalem being made of gold, there's a lot of racism. There's a lot of poverty. His name is changed. He's not born as Sharon. His name is Zauda. And they tell him he has to have an Israeli name. He has to have a Jewish name. How does he feel about that, right? Furthermore, I constantly heard conflicting voices. Some said Israeli society was racist. Others said it wasn't. Some said we had to throw our Ethiopian identity out the window. Some said we should preserve our traditions. I heard these two voices even within my own family. One day I asked my grandfather, Abba Dejan Mingasha, of blessed memory, Grandfather, how old are you? He replied, I'm 8 years old. I was astonished. 8 years old? How can that be? He answered that the moment he set foot on the ground of Jerusalem, he began to count the years of his life anew. I was thrilled. With all the complex reality of life after Aliyah, my grandfather still saw the light of Jerusalem. So there is this beautiful recognition of what we have received and what we need to give back to the state of Israel. And we'll just finish with this great cartoon, right? Which the tagline here is this, the Sabar, right? The young Israeli holding this very heavy sack, which says Aliyah Chadasha, new immigrants. And it says Yisrael, Zekzat Kaved. It's a little heavy, Aval Naim, but it's nice. Right? And that's the end of our story of Aliyah. Next time, we're going to talk about the story of lead up to the Six-Day War. So let's take a look at some questions that we have here. Hopefully in Bloom in Tel Aviv, money changer in a mismatched suit dealing with currency exchange. That's funny. Lansky, but not Siegel? Wasn't also Bugsy Siegel? I guess not. What book are the immigration maps in? Okay, this is an amazing book by the great Sir Martin Gilbert, Alav HaShalom, who wrote a lot of wonderful books, but to me, his greatest talent was as a cartographer. And this is a book called... what's it called? The Zionist Atlas, the Atlas of the State of Israel, something like that. I don't have any resources about the Tunisian Zionist movement, but there is a museum about the Jews of Libya, not Tunisia. I don't know so much, but Google. Yes, Martin Gilbert. Morocco, very little persecution. Morocco was better for Jews than other places. Hey, there were groups who came to Israel despite remaining anti-Zionist, mostly Haredi. Yes, because there weren't a lot of choices after the war. The art is amazing. I don't know what art we are talking about. So sorry, Karen, maybe you'll tell us. Israeli government on immigration. If anybody wants, yes, there's plenty and plenty of data if you would like. A museum of the mob, I wrote, is planned in Beit Shemesh. I know, I'm very excited about this museum, actually. There is a very small museum, but they want to make something bigger, and I think it's a wonderful idea. North, Nefesh B'Nefesh, go south and go north. Survivor testimony, right? Americans did not have that. Americans have their own baggage and their own other issues. Kastner was convicted, but he was exonerated later. Yes, thank you for the correction. Sound. Right. A lot of the Ma'abarot did not stay the same, meaning Rosh Ha'ayin starts out as a completely Yemenite town. Today it has many, many Russians as well. Barbed wire? I don't think so, but I'm not sure. Okay, share screen. America from West Side Story. Which one? The Yemenite song. I'll write the names of the songs. The Miriam Peretz has a book in English, but I don't think her speech is in it. Okay, Miriam Peretz's story. Yes, she had two sons who were killed in the army in two separate situations. And she's an inspirational speaker who talks about overcoming tragedy. She's an amazing, amazing speaker. First Ethiopian ordained as a rabbi in Israel. Yes, Sharon Shalom is also fascinating. Wrote an amazing book, if your Hebrew is good, about being able to reconcile or at least coexist Ethiopian halakha and rabbinic halakha. It's a fascinating thing. You could, oh, you have Rav Shalom Shalom spoke for you. Wonderful. Yes. Oh, the Art of Machane Yehuda. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
What?
No, he spoke first back in 2011.
Always good to put in a plug.
No, yeah, why not? Why not? You mentioned it. He's an amazing guy. Amazing. His story, how he escaped from Ethiopia.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy. Very interesting guy. He went to the yeshiva in the Gush, but then he also delved into Ethiopian halacha.
Yeah,
I'm putting here the second song. The Yemenite song is the Awa sisters. They're the ones who sing it. The name is Hana Mashu Al Yaman. And the other one is Yehuda Poliker, Chalon LaYam HaTichon. I don't know if you can put it in English, but you can try. No, that did not help. Okay. Yes. Any other questions, comments? Sorry, we went a little over.
Somebody.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. I don't know. Do you hear
you, the excellent.
Excellent job. Really wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for the help and the sharing.
Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shuli. We look forward to next week. This evening, Rabbi Shaul Robinson of Lincoln Square Synagogue will be giving our Parsha Shir at 8:30. And tomorrow morning, I'll be giving our Pirkei Avot Shir at 9:30 a.m. And then next week, all our schedules. I don't know if you can hear. Somebody put the tape on. Can everybody hear that, or is it just on my computer?
Oh, we hear.
Are you here? I don't know how to turn it off, but okay. Well, okay.
Thank you, Yeshkaya. Fascinating as always.
I will try.
Thank you, everyone. All right, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Be well, everybody.
Shabbat Shalom.
Beautiful. Great talk. Great presentation. Outstanding.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay.